Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 255, A Partial Eclipse of the Sun Spreads a Dark Veil Over Bloody Sandluwana. Just before we launch into the episode, a quick word about one of my all-time heroes of audiobook delivery, David Rattray. His series called The Day of the Dead Moon is one of the most captivating and detailed descriptions of the Battle of Sandluwana and the follow-up Battle of Rorke's Drift. I would like to dedicate this episode to David and his family and honor his memory. With that, we continue. When I ended last episode, a mounted patrol had stumbled on the main Zulu army of 20,000 men, which had been hunkered down in the Ngwebeni Valley, northeast of Sandluwana. The British had been conducting patrols both north and south of the Sphinx-shaped mountain, and had been following a group of Zulu who were foraging mealies and cattle for the huge army. Looking down on this huge force, the shocked British patrol had opened fire on the warriors from the vantage point and galloped away to warn Lieutenant Colonel Poulain back at Sandluwana about the impending threat. The effect of the fusillade on the Zulu warriors was instantaneous. Their discipline shattered. Huddled in silence for hours, they had been informed that the day of the attack would come on Thursday, 23rd of January, because the 22nd was the first day of the new moon, the day of the dead moon, the mnyama, or blackness, when dark spiritual forces lurked close to the fragile membrane that separated the living and the dead. None of the warriors had been prepared for battle through the customary rituals. They had not been drawn up in a circle, nor sprinkled with medicines to ward off the mnyama, nor had they been addressed by their commanders. Thus, no orders were given to attack on the 22nd, and despite the fear of mnyama, Inshingwayo Kamaholi Khoza's men responded to what they thought was a perfect moment. The Nkriyu regiment broke ranks, joined by the Nunkenke, the Ndududu, the Sanku, and Mbibe, who stood up and moved off at a rapid pace towards the Nyoni Heights, along with the Mbonambi, Ngobamakose, and the Uve. Their commanders, Inchingwayo and Mavumingwana Kandela and Tuli, tried to intercept these warriors, but they failed. Other regiments, like the Utulwana, the Ndluyengwe, the Ndlodlo, and the Ndloko, which had bivouacked further downstream in the Ngwebeni Valley on the Zulu left, remained seated. But the moment was too much for one of the more fiery Ndunas of the Utulwana, Ketuka Kai Makondo, the son of the Magwaza chief, who also broke away, sprinting after the Ngwiyu. The Zulu commanders worked quickly to settle down the rest of the army and pulled the remaining warriors into battle order, then marched off well behind those who had broken ranks. They used the depression behind the Nyoni Heights to obscure their movements from the British down at Sandluwana. Remarkably, the Zulu left had now become the Zulu right, the right were now the centre, and the centre had been pushed to the left. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Durnford's mounted reconnaissance patrol were beating a hasty retreat to Sandluwana. His sortie had always been ill-considered. If you recall last episode, Lord Chelmsford had ordered him to shore up the Sandluwana defences. Instead, he had arrived on the morning of the 22nd, and then taken off in pursuit of some glory, determined to throw himself and his men into the thick of fighting. Back at the British camp, Lieutenant Colonel Poulain was informed just before midday that the Zulu army was on its way. Theophilus Shepston Jr. relayed the information. Even today, there are acoustic peculiarities of the countryside around Sandluwana, which can possibly be explained by the sharp hills and the rolling, broken countryside. Sounds appear to bounce off the hills, echoing oddly, seemingly arriving in unexpected directions. During reenactments of the battle there, rifle volleys snap back and forth, providing almost no clue about the direction of fire. The sounds of these initial skirmishes merely confused those at Sandluwana. Reports were being fed back from the vedettes, the mounted scouts on the hills, including some high on Sandluwana itself. "The enemy are in three columns," went one. Then another. "The enemy are in force, behind the hills on the left." Then a third. "The enemy are retiring in every direction." It was just after midday that one came that was spot on. "The columns are separating, one moving to the left rear and one towards the general." That last report was critical. It was Shepston who arrived breathlessly with the last and suggested the men be concentrated from the outlying pickets into a central defensive area. Poulain was confused. This was against the standing orders he had received from Chelmsford, so Poulain said he wouldn't move the camp at present. There was no sense of urgency. He still thought the shooting sounds bouncing around the landscape were from Lord Chelmsford's relief battalions fighting out to the southeast, little realizing the existential crisis his entire column faced. Poulain had detached units to support Durnford, and his men were strung out along a picket line. Poulain was 40. Recently, he had been on detached duties. A Yorkshireman, son of a parson, he joined the 30th Regiment, then 3 years later, the 2nd and 24th. He'd spent time in Mauritius, Burma, and India before he purchased his rank of major in the 1st Battalion in 1871, then done service in Malta, Gibraltar, and the Cape. An efficient administrator, but his career so far had coincided with a particularly bloodless period in the 24th's history. That was until the Cape Frontier Wars in 1877. Even so, he'd not exercised command in a major engagement, and this was a major engagement. Prior to the invasion of Zululand, he'd helped set up a colonial unit called Poulain's Rangers in the Cape, recruited from the dross of settler society that were almost as much trouble as they were worth. British officers called them Poulain's Lambs, hardly a statement of confidence in their capacity. When the Anglo-Zulu War began on the 11th of January, 1879, he begged Chelmsford to be allowed to regain his regiment on active service, the 1st Battalion of the 24th. Chelmsford relented. Poulain wouldn't live very long to regret his request. The British, with their overwhelming firepower, were still at an advantage. They had modern rifles and artillery. It's very difficult to overcome a well-defended position over relatively open ground. But the British were scattered. The firing line extended. The Boers and colonial soldiers had repeatedly warned British commanders about their loose order, advising them to group defenders tightly together, preferably inside a laager of wagons. Even though the Zulu were also armed with muskets and some with rifles, concentrating firepower was the tried and tested technique in dealing with tens of thousands of warriors streaming toward your position. Poulain deployed his men and two guns a full kilometre to the north and east of St. Luana. It was a long, curved firing line based on a slight rise facing the Inyoni Heights. Below this, and between the rise and the Inyoni Heights, was a slight depression, a shallow valley. It was through this valley to the southeast that Colonel Durnford retreated towards St. Luana. The main part of the Zulu army was moving at extremely fast walking speed straight toward the British. The 1,700 men of the 1st and 3rd Natal Native Contingent, the 2nd and 3rd NNC, the 2nd and 24th British Regulars, the Royal Artillery, Colonial Mounted Men, and the 1st and 24th all arrayed in that order from north to south, turning to face the Zulu, who swept over the Nyoni Heights to the northeast. Had we been eyewitnesses, this sight would have impressed. About 10,000 warriors streaming over the Nyoni, down into the gully, plunging towards the British. Later, Zulu oral tradition spoke of the warriors' surprise that the British didn't flee at this point. Such was the breathtaking display of power and movement. Shepstone's men, the 1st and 24th NNC, were being driven back by this vast force. As the British opened fire, the Zulu adopted what survivors said later was a precise and well-drilled extended formation, harder to hit. Light lines of skirmishers who advanced one behind the other, reducing target size. The Zulu, contrary to popular perception, did not charge in suicidally at this point. They adopted a number of tactical moves that soldiers use today. They came on in rushes, advancing quickly, then dropping, lying prone, head down, as the fusillades flashed from the British soldiers. They were also making use of the cover available, the rocks, the bushes, to obscure themselves further. As the Zulu advanced, the right of this main army thinned out. In the centre, warriors advanced in lines 300 metres deep. They broke up into skirmishing groups, averaging about 10 or 12. A section or a mini platoon, in other words. They did not hurry now. It was a methodical approach. At the same time, the Zulu left horn swept across from the south, and they were hurrying, moving quicker than the centre. Their role was to swing around and split the defence. 8 kilometres away, towards the Nyezi Hill, Durnford's mounted unit was in big trouble. He had encountered the rapidly deploying Gombamakosi and the Uwe of the Zulu left, They were firing on his men from 800 meters away. Durnford retired steadily in skirmishing order. On the way, he picked up some survivors of the rocket battery, which had been wheeled up the Inyoni Heights to support Shepston's NNC. The battery had bashed into the Umbonambi regiment, managed to fire a single rocket before they were overwhelmed by a volley of fire from the Zulu. Vicious hand-to-hand fighting then followed, and Durnford had retreated into this sea of violence. Eventually, he was forced to stop at Adonga to the southeast of the camp, where the rest of his colonial mounted units gathered. This relatively small force of 200 was going to hold the 5,000 men of the Zulu left horn as it advanced from the south in an attempt at outflanking the British camp. The young and relatively hot-blooded Uwe began to take a terrible pounding from the accurate British fire. They had advanced quicker and then retreated quickly, repulsed as their losses mounted. The slower Ngubamakosi caught up with the youngsters and injected some choice spine into the fray, with a praise singer amongst them who called out, "Mbani, Mbani, we Zulu, kuya twazimula, langa langa amazulu, liyashi shakonje." Lightning, lightning of heaven, it glitters and it shines. The sun of the Zulus, it consumes all. Despite the praise singing, Durnford's colonials, many gifted riflemen, continued picking off the warriors. The left horn stalled. This was all made far worse by the 2 7-pounders, which began to find their range and hit the Umbonambi, causing severe casualties. Quick thinking, though, by their commander saved the regiment. They moved laterally to their left, further south, outflanking Durnford. All the while, the Zulu kept up a continuous and wild fire at the British as they advanced. They were firing too high, similar in a way to flinging their spears, which they always flung in an arc like a javelin. Soon, Zulu warriors lay in heaps, British firepower taking a terrible toll, but the Zulu continued advancing, in silence, which in some ways was even more terrifying than had they been shouting. The 7-pounder guns were booming away. The warriors now could see the gunners step away as they fired their shots, so they would drop to their chests, head down. Others parted ranks. Some of the shells found their mark, but now most passed harmlessly overhead or through the lines. Chelmsford had taken 6 of these guns with him when he went off to try to save Major Dartnell before dawn that very morning, leaving only 2 behind, hopelessly too few to cope with the volume of warriors pouring toward the British camp. After half an hour of fighting, the Zulu centre slowed to a crawl. The Mkhiyu, the Apo, the men who charged off without waiting for their commander's orders, and it was these who'd suffered the highest casualties of this day. It was Shepston's mounted colonial cavalry who caused much of the damage, fighting steadily back to Sandilwana from the north, where Shepston had been conducting his own sweep, like Durnford further south. Companies of the British regular troops, the 24th, joined his men on a slight rise. The Zulu chest, the centre, was exposed in the hollow between the Inyoni Heights and the rocky ridge that Shepston held. The Zulu attack had stalled. Critically, it was the horns, both left and right, would save the day for Cetshwayo's men. The Nkenke, the Dududu, the Mbibe, the Sanku all managed to race along in a wide flanking movement to the north of Sandilwana, to the right, with the aim of joining up with the Zulu left horn to the south. The right horn was also to cut off the main road to Rorke's Drift, but first they faced stubborn resistance from Lieutenant Cavey of E Company, along with 20-year-old Lieutenant Dyson, his 2IC. Little did these two know, but the orders had put them directly in the sights of the huge Zulu right horn. They had followed a trodden local path up Tahilani Ridge to the north of the battlefield, onto a crest that allowed a clear view to the aloe-strewn north. Cavey sent pickets out to the northeast. Minutes later, thousands of men of the Nkenke and the Nodwengu regiments from the right passed the horsemen, trotting parallel with the crest line about 0.5 kilometre away. Cavey ordered his men to spread out on the ridge and load. The warriors had seen them, but they continued trotting forward. Cavey shouted, "Company, ready! Company, fire!" 200 rifles sent their bone-crunching rounds towards the Amabutu. Undeterred, the warriors continued jogging forward, rapidly moving out of range. E Company moved further west and fired again. Moments later, the retreating Natal native horse contingent rode into view, closely followed by the Nkenke and the Mthiyo regiments. Soon the Zulu were within 200 metres of this northern British force. Captain Mostain of F Company hurried to reinforce Cathay. All were forced off the crest line, now running short of ammunition. In a moment, seemingly a madness, the British counter-attacked the Zulu right horn, pushing the warriors back to the crest. Then, those on Tahailani Ridge caught sight of the rest of the right horn, the Dududu, Nokenke, and the Nodwengu remnants on their left. They had been outflanked, forced to retreat, soon speared and shot as they staggered back to the northern slopes of Zandluana, where their bodies were found later. Meanwhile, the Mbunami on the left horn were determined to outflank Durnford, and they were going to use heavy weapons to do that. Cattle. The warriors formed up a herd of maddened cows and drove the wretched beasts before them to distract the British. They succeeded in outflanking Durnford's men in the Donga and began to pour into the camp from the south, supported by the Uve regiment, which had caught up. The British defence wilted under pressure from the left horn, while the Zulu right horn completed its turn to the west of Zandluana, with the Nonkenke charging over the saddle of the hill and other units passing all the way around the back to join up with the left horn as planned. The British were surrounded. Durnford's men continued streaming back toward the camp, in danger of being cut off. This left a gap in the defences as they fled, and then Ngobamakosi surged through the gap and fell upon the infantry stragglers. Poulain ordered a ceasefire, telling his men to tighten into a central group under the slopes of Zandluana, the very thing that the Zulu commanders had been waiting for. Both Nchingwao and Mabubingwen were standing on the Inyoni Heights just to the north of the Nkliyu, watching the battle. As the British fell back, the Zulu commanders realized their moment had come. It was time to mobilize the frozen and demoralized Zulu center once more. Nkliyu, Nduna and Dlaka was dispatched and ran down the hill toward the warriors who were cowering under cover, screaming, "You did not say you were going to lie down!" And "the little branch of leaves that beats out the fire," that's a reference to Tlejwayo, "did not order this." Running down a slope in an exposed position was the last act he committed. Dlaka fell dead, shot through the head. But he had roused Nkliyu with his death-defying rush. They rose and charged towards the British, reinvigorated. Other units were equally motivated to join. Ngobamakosi Nduna Sikizani Kanomikeje yelled at his men that the Mgliu was showing spine. "What of you?" he said. "Why are you lying down? What was it you said to the Mgliu?" The Mgliu closed in on the British tent camp, throwing away their firearms and shifting to their spears, followed by the Uve and the Mbunami. Still, they did not sprint. They stayed low, moving at fast walking speed, a steady and determined pace, making a low, murmuring sound now, like thousands of buzzing bees. About 100 metres from the British line, they shouted, "Usutu!" Suddenly they charged at the double, pouring down a shower of throwing spears, as the British desperately fired case shot from their artillery as a last-ditch effort to halt the assault. It had no effect. The warriors in the front ranks fell, but those behind pushed through their bodies and overran the troops, trying to make it to their camp, only a short distance behind. It was around now that Poulain was killed. Ududu and Sanku waited in the valley behind Zandluana, between the mountain and Rorke's Drift. They planned to block a British retreat, but many had already broken off, chasing the Natal native contingent troops and mounted colonials who were trying to flee to safety. There was an extremely narrow gap for the rest of the British regulars who by some miracle had survived the Zulu onslaught and tried to make their escape to Rorke's Drift. Other Zulu regiments marched up from the rear, the Tulwana, Luyengwe, Idloko, then Lordlaw reserves. They had hoped to finish off the British, but could see that the existing Zulu force was doing that just fine, so they turned and headed off toward Rorke's Drift. As this battle reached its apex soon after 2 p.m., a remarkable event took place. A partial eclipse of the sun was recorded. As the British and Zulu fought hand-to-hand struggles inside the camp, the darkness seeping across the veldt added to the supernatural horrors of war. For Nchingwao and Mabubingwana, the eclipse was a terrible portent. This was an omen of Mnyama, the Ides. It meant a considerable loss of life, and not just on the British side. Some of the British mounted men galloped from the battle site as it became obvious who was going to be victorious. These men were heading towards the main road to Rorke's Drift. In front of them, the Zulu right horn and the reserve, eager to end their journey. Other British and Natal native contingent troops fled in a desperate sprint through a gap left by the Ratoan down towards the Mzinyati River, Fugitive's Trail, as it would become known. The Dududu, Mbibe, and Sanku pursued these fugitives down to the river, which was covered with rocks and bushes, bad ground for horses. The running Zulu warriors easily kept up with the fleeing British. Still, the fugitives didn't give up. They fired back, and the Zulu took more heavy casualties. Both parties fought to the death. Many soldiers reached the banks of the swollen Mzinyati, only to die by drowning in the frenzied brown and yellow water of summer rain. Others who struggled across found terror had not ended. They were in the vicinity of Sotondosi's Drift, Fugitive's Drift, as it became known, only to run into Gamdana's warriors, who had avoided submitting to British law. They waited on the Natal side, joined by some of the Zulu warriors who'd swum across. Gamdana's men killed as many of the stragglers as they could find, a never-ending struggle against sudden death. Luckily for others, the main group of Zulu chasing the fugitives headed upstream, crossing into Natal at a far safer point, thus providing some with the opportunity to get away. Back at Isandlwana, the fighting continued. Men were shoulder to shoulder in a last stand. A few others still tried to conduct a disciplined withdrawal towards Mzinyati. These half-company strength bands of around a few dozen men were systematically cut off from one another. Out of ammunition, they swung their deadly bayonets in a last-ditch attempt at survival. Zulu oral tradition speaks of this part of the battle, where a great number of warriors died trying to quell the final groups. The Zulu preferred to stand off from these regular soldiers and use their throwing spears rather than risk coming within striking distance of their deadly bayonets. Then the eclipse passed, signifying the last breaths of 52 British officers, including Poulain and Durnford, 850 regular troops, 500 colonials, and Natal native contingent men, around 1,400 of the British troops in total. The Zulu took no prisoners. They killed almost everything that lived, men, cattle, mules, dogs, most of the horses, although some were saved to take back to Cetshwayo and senior chief Hamel. This was the way of the Zulu, and had been for generations. Even the 12-year-old drummer boys were strung up and speared. The Zulu then set about disemboweling the dead, for the British had fought with honour and courage, and therefore, in Zulu military tradition, their bowels should be split open so that the spirit would be set free, and when decomposition set in, the bodies would not bloat. The soldiers' watches and money were carefully removed. These were valuable to all. The Amabutho looted the camp, taking the two field guns and some wagons back to Cetshwayo Kampandi, cutting the tents up for their cloth, and saving the bell portion to show the king. Firearms were seized, cartridges, blankets, waterproof sheets, axes, shovels, picks, saddles. Zulu seized 40,000 cartridges, 800 Martini Henry rifles, and these were displayed later for Cetshwayo to see. He would wisely let the warriors keep their rifles as payment for a job well done. Warriors took sacks of food as well as the hard-tack biscuits, but they didn't realize that the tin products were food and threw these away. Some drank from the bottles scattered around the camp. Most of these were wine or spirits, perhaps champagne. Others contained paraffin and chemicals from the veterinarian's wagon. Warriors were poisoned. Some died. Fires burned, but most of the goods were left where they were. A tumble-down memorial of death, bodies, camp beds, smashed boxes, books, photographs fluttering in the breeze, cricket pads and bats, journals, letters, papers flittering like butterflies' memories in the mid-afternoon Zululand summer breeze. The victorious Zulu army retraced their steps to the northeast across the Nyoni Heights, down into the Ngubeni Valley, where they had started their attack. Here they halted, mainly because of the number of their wounded who could not move. Usually, the Zulu would cover one of their friends or relatives killed in battle with the victim's shield, but on this occasion, they did something unusual. They went to the trouble of burying many of their dead in the mealie pits of Tu'umizi, nearby homesteads, and in dongas and antbear holes around the enigmatic hill of Isandlwana. A proper grave for a proper warrior, About 100 kilometers away in Undini, Gletshwayo Kampani was already sitting in his private hut, the Inkatha Yesizwe, where the sacred coil of the nation lay. He'd been told by messengers that the battle with Sandlwana had begun. It was the power of his long-dead ancestors like Shaka that were bound together in this coil. He sat on the Inkatha holding the Inhlendla, the ceremonial spear with a wicked barbed blade. As he brooded on this throne, he was ensuring that his warriors would fight with purpose and that victory would be theirs. Undoubtedly, the battle was already over by the time the first messenger arrived, but Gletshwayo was living in a supernatural plane that recognized no time lag, a cosmological time travel of sorts. More messengers arrived with news that his men were heading toward victory, and Gletshwayo, like every king, eventually needed to relieve himself. But when he snuck out of the royal hut to go past Urien, the royal mothers spotted him and said, "Aye, the consequences of your inattention would be dire." Later, Gletshwayo was informed of the heavy casualties that men had taken, and he was furious. At least 1,000 dead, perhaps as many as 2,000. Maybe he had risen to his toilet too soon. Late in the afternoon of Wednesday, 22nd of January, 1879, Lord Chelmsford's men were spotted by Zulu observers advancing in battle order toward the camp of death, where no eye remained open to weep. Inchingwayo could have caused even more mayhem had he ambushed Chelmsford, but in reality, the Zulu army nearby was in no condition to continue to fight at Sandlwana, and left the shocked general to ponder his catastrophe. Next episode, we'll begin the tale of the follow-up battle of Rorke's Drift. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there or sign up for my newsletter. Until next, goodbye.